You can now book for the National Association for Primary Education Conference 2024. This is focusing on SEND challenges and strategies. Join them at the University of Bedfordshire for a day filled with insightful discussion, workshops and networking opportunities. You can attend in person or online by visiting nape.org.uk/conference-2024. That's nape.org.uk/conference-2024.
Hello, my name is Mark Taylor and welcome to the Education on Fire podcast. The place for creative and inspiring learning from around the world. Listen to teachers, parents and mentors share how they are supporting children to live their best authentic life and are proving to be a guiding light to us all.
Hello, welcome back to the Education on Fire podcast. Great to be back with you as always. Depending on which platform you're listening on, do make sure you hit that follow button. We're going to have one or two bonus episodes coming out probably on a Thursday, maybe a Friday in the next few weeks. I just want to spend some individual time being able to chat with you and discuss where I am with the podcast, where we think the podcast might expand going forward, my plans for the summer, and just to give you a little bit of an insight of sort of where we are, what we're planning and how we're going to see the podcast evolve over the next sort of year or so. But today I'm delighted to be chatting to Dr. Tim Dacey, and he has a long history in AI and learning science and recently published the book Wisdom Factories, AI, Games and the Education of a Modern Worker. After 30 years at MIT leading AI development for diverse government needs, Tim leapt into education due to concerns that minds won't be ready for the jobs that remain human. He has experience of teaching at corporate, higher ed and K-12 levels, and Dr. Casey has atypical perspectives on the future of schooling built from a blend of AI expertise, experience with many industries, depth in the science of learning and judgment, and more than a decade leading development of game-based learning tools. Now, AI is obviously a hot topic at the moment, but I think having these conversations with people who really understand what's going on and how it's going to fit within our lives, both now and going forward, certainly for our children, are really important conversations. So I really hope you enjoy this conversation with Dr. Tim Dacey. Hi, Tim. Thank you so much for joining us here on the Education on Fire podcast. AI is something which has come up a lot recently, and I'm hoping, and from the conversations that we're having, that maybe this might be the thing that just tips us over the edge to make that educational change, because it'll be a necessity for everyone, even though we've been talking about how maybe the system should be different for a long time. Yeah, so thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, Mark. Appreciate it.
So take us into your expertise in terms of where sort of AI came into your world and your sort of that sort of beginning knowledge of it.
Yeah, I started working in AI in graduate school, which was late 80s. So I'm an old timer in this field. But I was coming about it even then from a different perspective, because I was in a biomedical engineering program and was doing brain modeling. So I was working with some of the same artificial neural network techniques that dominate AI now, but really applying it to how does the brain work. And that combination has carried through my career. I spent most of my time, 30 years of my career at MIT, leading research and development groups, a lot of it in AI, but a lot of it also, I think the perspectives that I brought to both my book and to this conversation are about, you know, what are we seeing in terms of the deficits in the workplace, in terms of personal skill, and how do adults learn? We learned some things about how that's done well. So hopefully that could be applied to us at primary and secondary as well.
So I guess the first thing, which is an obvious thing, is the fact that AI, everyone thinks, is suddenly an explosion in the here and now, certainly in the last year or so. But like I say, it's got a long history of actually sort of being in the workforce and in the world at large.
It is. But I think what's the key difference in the last year is it's democratized. So it's no longer just the purview of a few people with, you know, highly sophisticated technical skills. It's something that everybody can now use. And, you know, the capabilities of the AI that's come out in the last year are dramatically different and really surprised a lot of people in the AI community who weren't sure that any of the techniques that were being applied would be this successful.
And I guess it's really the application is going to be the model for how this is going to go forward, certainly in the education space, because I think a lot of people are kind of unsure of how it's going to look. Does the role of school look different? Do the teachers look different? So having sort of had that sort of longevity of AI and as sort of technology sort of moved on, what do you sort of think might the sort of the more modern classroom look like, and sort of, and what do you sort of get from that in terms of how you sort of went through that when you were writing your book?
I'll take that in two stages, two timelines, I guess. First would be the here and now. So what is AI going to do in the classroom now? I've been telling educators, focus on yourself. Now, I know there's this, certainly a need to deal with how students use AI in various ways. But the biggest benefit to an educator should be, especially to younger and less experienced educators, should be to decrease the amount of drudgery time that you spend doing a lot of detailed work, either in lesson prep and grading and, in routine communications, things of that sort. So that's a near term. And that's not really where my book is going. The second is what I would call the 5 to 10 year timeline. And there I have potentially bad news for educators, which is the AI, in terms of content delivery, the AI is just going to be much more capable and smarter than any human being. And that's already happened. You know, the GPT-4, which is the base for the paid version of ChatGPT, took an IQ test and scored 155. So that's way above genius level for those that are unfamiliar with the scale. And so there's a lot of press about how it makes mistakes, and it certainly does. But it can do better than most humans, and especially when you have humans curating what it does. I think the notion that teachers will be primarily responsible for delivering knowledge is probably not going to be the case. And that will allow a lot of individualization of benefiting the students. It won't mean you won't need teachers. I mean, that certainly may happen in third world settings or other places where educators aren't available. But those teachers are going to be much more focused on the things that only someone physically present knowing these individuals can deal with. And so I think there'll be good and bad. It may be good for a teacher because it removes some of the workload. But I think a lot of educators will probably miss that.
And I guess that, like I say, it depends where you are, maybe on your career path and how long you've been involved, whether you sort of jump on that is this is fantastic because it's now going to give you the longevity. We know lots of teachers are sort of changing out into a different career sort of within the first sort of 5 years or so. And like you say, that ability to put yourself first and the whole idea of self-care and well-being, and like I say, absolutely, being able to bring that into the pupils as well is an exciting prospect, because we know that mental health is a real problem at the moment, and I think education's at the heart of that in so many ways, in terms of what children kind of believe has to be the case, you know, the having to know all the answers and all that sort of thing. And I think what we're talking about here is the fact that just the essence of what learning and education is going to be is going to be different. And I think once that's kind of shattered, then the model has to look very different very quickly. I guess my next question's there going to be, do you think the government of the world will probably be in a position to change that system in advance of that, to kind of really sort of enhance the ability that's there? Or do you think, as has been the case in the sort of the last few decades, there's sort of that sort of dragging our heels because we're not quite sure how to move that tanker to make the best of what's available to us now compared to, you know, let's say that sort of historical idea of what learning should be?
Oh, goodness, no. The governments and really large institutions in general will not move fast enough. Not for this. I mean, this is moving so much faster than hugely disruptive technologies did in the past. So, you know, this is akin to electricity or the introduction of personal computers, right? Which took decades, really, to roll out and to have effect to individuals. But you're now able to tap into AI immediately. And the pace even of improvement in these things, these AIs, especially the language and image generation models is really incredible over the last year. There was advance in the first 5 months after ChatGPT was released that was greater than all other AI advance before that, over a 5-month period. And that's still continuing. We don't know when that will level off, but the impact is dramatic, and large institutions just don't know how to change very well. A big focus of my book and my consulting is on durable skills, or 21st century skills, or I'm not sure how it's referred to in the UK, but that's been something that the community has known for decades now, that's important to build those skills. And yet the paradigm hasn't been adjusted to deal with that, right? We're still really focused on knowledge delivery, and that's what we test for. And there may be little pieces that we layer on top that are about critical thinking or creativity or something else. But for the most part, we still, we're still stuck in the same mode. And that's really going to be intolerable in the future. And I think that we're starting to see both parents and students recognize the disconnect between what they see being useful and necessary in their adult lives and what's being taught in school. That's increasingly the case. You know, when I was going through secondary school, you know, me learning how to solve algebraic equations and learning the periodic table, learning all these deep repositories of knowledge, that was useful to me in my technical career. That isn't useful anymore because I can look it up in 2 seconds.
Yeah.
And increasingly the problems that have to do algebra or something else are automated. And we don't generally teach those methods about how those things are automated. So as the world has moved on, the education system hasn't adjusted. And I think what's happened over time is there's, both people within the system and authorities that lord over it are talking themselves into keeping it the same. So you'll hear, if I were to sit down with a math teacher, a high school math teacher here in the U.S., and I have done this, and said, well, you know that what you're teaching nobody really uses in the workplace, I'll inevitably get some other rationale. I'll get, okay, well, we're teaching them to think, or, you know, this is teaching them a certain kind of logic that will be useful in their adult lives. But in fact, if you, in any workplace or any gathering of adults that you see, you'll see that there's not a lot of logic that adults tend to apply. And you'll see that there's not a lot of critical thinking that they tend to. Those are clear weaknesses in our society. So whatever residue of what we're teaching that you expect to come off and sort of lead to these durable, transferable skills isn't happening. And so it's a way of the system, and I don't think this is true of individual educators, but I think of the system as a whole talks itself into not changing, because it's difficult to change. It's very hard on mindsets on almost every part of the system.
Yeah, absolutely. And also the other side of that, which we've spoken about before on the show, is the fact that, like you say, there are businesses and organizations out there who are wanting it to be different because they know those skills need to be different for what they need. I think the exciting thing for me is the fact that what you said there about the fact that individuals and parents are starting to really feel that disconnect. And I think what the technology is starting to do is to give you the opportunity to, if I have to go to school, I have to go to school, but I can do it differently, or I can do part of it differently, or I can get the understanding and the skills that I need on my own. And I think that means that things can change and you feel like you've got a little bit more control. And I think that the sort of schooling and the sort of learning you're talking about, which is very sort of human-centered and personal-centered, and sort of collaborative from that point of view, I think is a very positive thing for us as a species, as it were, because that's getting back to the essence of who we are. And I think it's interesting that, you know, it's going to be technology maybe which actually gives us who we are back, if that kind of makes sense.
Absolutely. I think highly disruptive things, you know, whether it's the pandemic, or it's AI, or, you know, I think will always be necessary, unfortunately. Crises are kind of necessary for major change. I wish it weren't so, but this will become a crisis, although it's not clear to me that education won't just put their fingers in their ear. I'm talking very broadly, not about classroom level educators, but it's not clear that there won't be sort of a collective putting your fingers in your ear. I think a lot about what are the ways that the broader world can affect and influence schooling. And at least here in the United States, there's a very weak connection between business and what they need, and what colleges do, or what primary and secondary schools do. So, you know, that means parents have a huge role.
Yeah.
And to the extent that parents can if you look at what's the difference in these durable skill capabilities, if you sort of take a step back and say, you know, the students that come out of the system being great at critical thinking, what's the main difference? The evidence points to it's their home life, not their school life, right? Do they have educated parents who talk about issues with trade-offs and complexities and use language and logic to describe things? Or do they have less adult input at home and less vocabulary and all the other things that the evidence is pointing to? So that in itself sort of says we're not learning those skills at school by and large. We're learning them based on our home environment and vicariously sort of by being around people who think and talk in more sophisticated ways.
Yeah, and that just means that the gap's going to get wider, isn't it? Because the people that do have those conversations are going to be getting more of that, and those that don't are going to be missing out.
Unless school fills that void.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly that. And another interesting thing I've heard recently is the fact that someone was saying to me, you sort of mentioned there about businesses, that actually one of the ways that maybe things will change is actually businesses stepping up and being very vocal or very supportive about learning in a certain way, partly because they need it in all the ways that we've been talking about so far, but also because they then do have the power, because they have the voice, the size, the ability to make positive change with a voice that does it in some way or another. And it would take a really massive collective way of that happening. Who knows whether that's possible, but it would be quite seismic. But maybe, you know, like I say, as it starts to fall apart or becomes less and less relevant, that maybe there'll be a group of them that do that.
Yeah, I think by and large, business doesn't look far enough ahead for that. The bigger players, Apple, Google, Microsoft, all have huge, you know, fairly sizable educational initiatives. But a lot of them are about leapfrogging school, not helping school. There's sort of a collective feeling of a helplessness when it comes to trying to change schools. I think one of the first things I'm starting to work with, for example, HR departments and businesses, and I think one of the first things you'll see in business that will be faster moving than what I think education can do, is the way people are hired will change. So one of the things I worked a lot on with adult communities in my career was on a game-based learning. So we would put people, we did this because we wanted to know what AI to build for them, but we would put people in realistic job situations, maybe ones that they aren't typical for what they encounter, right? But put them in these sort of unusual situations that really clarify the difference between what somebody with a lot of experience would be able to do and somebody who's new. And then let them make decisions. And it turns out that kind of job tryout is more likely to be happening in hiring processes than the traditional interview, or at least it will be a part. You're starting to see that happen already. But the rationale there is I can look at a resume and I can't tell whether you're a good critical thinker from a resume. I can't even tell it necessarily from asking people you used to work with, because that may have whatever personal relationships or biases, or, you know, I may just be helping my friend out, right? So how do I get to being able to assess those qualities? That actually might be an important step, because what that does, businesses are doing it for themselves, right? Just to be able to hire the people who have those skills that they want, those quote unquote soft skills. But what that does is that's a feedback signal to colleges about what they need. You could imagine even having students take those same tests if they're studying to be an educator, right? Maybe they're in a virtual environment that assesses their class management skills, you know, puts them in particular situations, helps them understand, you know, and evaluates everything from, you know, where they're positioned to what their vocal tone is to what their facial expressions are and, you know, how that matches with the student's, you know, personality and psychological profile might be. So right now there are a whole range of skills that we kind of, you know, whether consciously or not, collectively kind of give up on, right? They're the kind of skills that you just build through your career. When I briefly taught middle school computer science, and you know, I knew going in that the biggest issue I was going to have was class management. And you know, all my advisors sat down and said the same thing. That's, you're going to struggle with class management. So I said, okay, give me some advice. And the advice I got was, well, you're just going to have to figure it out. Everybody's got their own style. And I was like, well, isn't there somewhere I could practice this, right? I'd like to figure this out sooner than day one.
Yeah, exactly, know? Before I'm stood there, yeah.
And it turns out, you know, teachers in typical educational programs, at least over on this side of the Atlantic, are not put in classroom situations very often. They're not given, armed with a lot of information about psychology and, you know, the sort of fundamentals of you know, as an example, I think most educators don't really understand a lot of the special needs populations very well. I, you know, personally have a bit of ADHD, and I would intuitively understand some of my kids who did, but most of the teachers really didn't. I mean, they could read whatever was on the guidance that the school counselors and the students' own medical professionals would give, but they didn't intuit that, gee, if I do this, that's going to affect this kid in this way. And so, you know, there's a lot in terms of teacher education that we put on people to learn on the job. And that means it's hell for the first few years, right? Because you're just not good at things. And everything you do takes you a long time, a lot longer than an experienced professional. And that's actually one of the areas where AI is being shown, you know, over the last year as these chatbots have come out, as an example. There have been a lot of, you know, business schools and economists that are trying to figure out, well, does this really improve performance and productivity? And if so, in what ways? And the performance gain is pretty big. Just using, for example, just using ChatGPT, the paid version, by the way, not the free version, with dramatically different performance levels. Just using ChatGPT in the job usually gives the individual worker anywhere from a 20 to 60% improvement in productivity. And similar, that's more subjective, but similar levels of improvement in quality. But it's not the hugely experienced people that are getting that benefit. It's the newbies. So it has a tendency, the AI is an assistant that has a tendency to bring competency level up of those who are less experienced. And that makes sense, right? That's where you need extra assistance and extra credit. And as time goes on and you learn the best way to manage a class or create a lesson and, or whatever it might be, you get better and better. So I think that's good news for new teachers, you know, because we're certainly losing them in droves, especially in the first few years.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it means they have to be, there has to be, you know, an emphasis on that in how we prepare teachers.
Yeah.
And certainly how we help them as they're in the environment. And the number one thing that I learned being a teacher for a little bit was you're just overwhelmed with details. You don't have time to step back and think. And that's you know, you can't change if you can't step back and think. And so that's step one, is how do we get the workload down?
Yeah. And like you say, that's where you need, the one thing you need is time, and the one thing you're never going to get given is time. and sort of, yeah.
Yeah.
And then we're back to square one again. So take us into your book in terms of, where did it start from? What was the sort of the initial kind of point where you thought, no, there's a conversation here, there's a thing I want to be able to sort of share with the world, and sort of that journey into getting it out there?
Well, I should point out, at least at the intersection that I was at with AI and neuroscience, I was always thinking about how we learn and how machines learn. And there's a lot of parallels between the two. Obviously not perfect. These AIs are not people. But there would be commonalities. I'll give you one example. So if I wanted to teach an AI a certain concept, let's say it was recognizing your face. The way to do that is to give it lots of examples of your face in a whole range and variety of situations. If I give you the same picture over and over, it's going to have less ability to generalize, right? So what matters for teaching a concept then, and if I were to take this to human learning, that concept of Mark's face, it's not a single piece of knowledge, but it's learned kind of experientially. Humans aren't going to do a good job with that either if they only see one picture of you, right? So this notion of repetition that is often part of how we think about delivering detailed knowledge is really not the right concept when it comes to teaching concepts. So you need that variation, and especially the things that are kind of on the boundary of your face or something similar. And so one is that I kind of learned just general principles of learning through looking both at it from an how to train machines perspective and a human perspective. But what really ended up changing my mind on a lot of things was when we got involved in developing these game-based learning paradigms, or we were using them just as analytical tools to try to measure how people made decisions in their jobs. And so we weren't using them initially to try to train people. And we used these across a whole range of fields, everything from public health and disaster management, lots of different security and defense problems. I worked on medical training. I worked on air traffic control. And across all of those, we couldn't peel these people away from these games. And they came out of them talking about their jobs in completely different ways. We would have a conversation beforehand, and we would, about how their jobs could be different with technology, how technology could help them. Very unimaginative answers. We would put them in a situation where they had to make decisions in their job that were not the norm for them, that maybe they come up every 6 months, a year. Maybe they're unlikely to ever get that situation. Have them make decisions there and then ask them what technology they needed. Much, much richer answers. Much more retrospectively, very introspective kinds of thoughts. And that really struck me. And we would even do things where, I remember one time we took a set of public health disease investigators and put them into a law enforcement game where we were having detectives piece together various kinds of evidence. And those disease detectives did great at the law enforcement game. Not quite as well as law enforcement, but they did a heck of a lot better than these, pretty smart MIT scientists who we had also baselining it. So there was also transferability when we played these things, where we could see these skills, these very intuitive, tacit knowledge kinds of skills that I couldn't define very well with a PowerPoint chart, but I would see these kinds of both the engagement level, but also the learning and how it opened up and unlocked some of these intuitions. I started really thinking about how that would be applied to students and what those would look like. That kind of percolated for a decade or so until I was really ready to move to another part of my career, which was last year when I did so. But when I decided to move on, and I essentially decided to move from the developer side of the AI equation to the user side to try to help people deal with it. And so the first thing I wanted to do was really talk about what I had seen in those adult populations and how I think that is really a paradigm, the sort of doing something paradigm, right? If you want people to be better at anything, and that includes the durable skills, you have to have practice. And you have to have quite varied practice, right? If I'm going to try to teach critical thinking, and I teach it only for critical thinking and chemistry, well, I'm probably not helping the overall skill. It has to be these multi-perspective, multi-dimensional problems that have trade-offs and uncertainties and have more than one answer that can come out that are all valid.
And I guess that's where sort of project-based learning kind of is a positive thing in the current system and the way that goes, because like I say, using multi levels of what you know about different things in order to maybe solve a problem or create something in that way. And the other thing that I really thought was fascinating from what you said was that sense of actually sort of giving lots of different pitches to the AI in terms of knowing who I am in different situations. And that makes perfect sense. And it also points out why, like say, being able to connect with a student would work in the same way. If you only know the student because they sit at this table and they wear their uniform in this way, or wear their clothes, whichever it happens to be, if they don't have a uniform, and they ask the same sorts of questions or don't ask any questions. It's only when you've asked different questions, you've made those conversations, you know more about the child as a whole, that you're going to then make a big difference to then be able to help them in that way. And then, like I say, you've got more of that 360 idea and a more rounded way of being able to help them, which just takes you back into that personalized learning again, which you say can then be sort of fed into sort of being the most productive way of supporting a child.
That's right. I mean, if you, and I think you do at the end of your podcast, ask about people's favorite teachers. Yeah. And I would bet that, at least it is in my experience asking people about that, that what people talk about is when a teacher connected to them individually, right? Not that they were part of a class and they loved that material, but connected to them at an individual level, and or there was something that engaged their minds in a project form over a long period of the course. And, you know, that I think goes to some fundamentals of humanity and how our brains work, right? Getting lots of short hit, bursty kinds of tasks that don't allow us to connect in a flow across. It's just not the way we learn best. And secondly, I think that part of, you know, it's usually some kind of task where you had agency. You got to pick some aspect of it. I was struck, we were talking because you mentioned you had a musical background, and I was really struck by my daughter's music education, which really was quite good. I mean, had a lot of great teachers, but do you know, never once did they ask them to compose a piece of music, even just to hum a little tune, or never once, you know, very little of the music theory really got across. What they learned was how to perform for parents. And so, you know, that's just a little example, but you could almost say the same thing. And there are, you know, I would say in the English language area, you know, that's much more practice. And usually there are units that go on for longer stretches. But, you know, in science and math, there's little sense that there's a kind of thinking process and a logic that has to, that is built up by trying and failing and trying again. And instead, we try to teach students to come to sort of single correct answers. And that's kind of not how the real world works. So,
yeah, I can relate to that, exactly. Yeah. I think also it's a really important point that you made there about the longevity and also what you show. I mean, that particular example, like say about a performance or something in school as a music teacher, I know exactly what that's like. But a bit like the comments you made earlier on, you need that sort of real sort of ability to stand back, because if you're able to teach the music theory, you're doing the competition, you've got a real rounded knowledge and education on whatever that subject happens to be. The performance that you may be is the thing that parents want to see, or the thing which showcases their ability, comes from all of that understanding and knowledge and shines even brighter than the kind of by next week we need to be able to do this, so we're going to just sort of really knuckle down and learn this song and be able to sort of get it across in the best possible way. But I guess that's the essence of maybe where we are within learning generally. It's about the test, it's about by this age you've got to be like this, and we have to kind of hit all these goals. And like I said about the teachers, that's really what often may be the case. Either they're fantastic at schooling what they need to school by what they're told they have to do. That's not the same as learning. It's not the same as giving them the skills that they need, because that isn't assessed in that same way, and it's deemed not to be important because that's what they're being told.
Right. We learned a lot of knowledge. There was a really good reason for teaching a lot of detail for much of the, you know, mass education's history, right? Because you didn't have other things that could remember that detail for you, and it would take a lot longer to look things up. So if it was in your head, it had real worth and value in life in the workplace. But as computers started to remember things for us, and as the amount of knowledge really started to explode, the amount of potential knowledge that you could learn, then I think a lot of the educational system really tried to stuff more and more into students' heads and carve up learning time into shorter and shorter units. And you know, it's a no-win proposition to go that direction, because, you know, here there are even some states. There was a law that was passed in California recently that requires cursive writing instruction in elementary school. You know, and I just like bang my head against the desk when I hear stuff like that. Because the rationale ends up being, well, somebody's going to need to be able to sign their name, or they're going to be able to read some old text that was written, handwritten. Well, but that's, you know, if you start evaluating what you teach by does it have value, then you're going to find that everything you already teach has value. If instead you ask the question, what's the best way to teach a skill, you get a different answer, right? Okay, if I'm trying to teach fine motor coordination, or I'm trying to teach cursive, yeah, somebody will use that, right? But maybe not most of the kids. Maybe I could have gotten away with playing a musical instrument as another way of teaching fine motor coordination, right? And I didn't need the cursive. So I think the biggest theme of the book is that our whole schooling experience, and it is the, and that means the curriculum, the very structure, the kinds of subjects we choose as part of a curriculum, is really all carved up based on specialized knowledge domains. But if we're to get to these durable 21st century skills like critical thinking and creativity and, you know, collaboration ability, those aren't easily served by single specialty teaching. They're served by having a class or a subject in critical thinking, or a class and a subject in. So when the schools structurally change, then I'll believe they're really changing. But if they're keeping the same curriculum and pedagogies and trying to stuff these other skills into them, they're just never going to get there. Yeah. And that, you know, that is a fairly logical, but I don't think is recognized by most people. I mean, I could just very easily see somebody being pulled into, you know, just because AI will be doing a lot of the detailed work, I could see careers start to emerge that are literally like, you're a critical thinking specialist. You are an innovation specialist. That's your job. It's not chemistry, or it's not, you know, it's not sales. It's, you know, here's your, you are an expert at thinking through the processes for figuring these things out in this way. And that'll, I think, naturally emerge on the business side. And the question is whether school will adapt to that. Yeah. It's going to be difficult. It's not just primary and secondary. Higher education is perhaps even more stuck in their ways and less able to change.
Yeah. And like you say, often the next stage. And I think that's a really well put idea of it. It's about the questions. It's about setting the ball rolling, which is where we're going to be at our most important. And I think what you said about the way the system is, it reminds me a little bit about well-being. You know, it's massive. It's been talked about all the time. However, it seems to me that it's the same as what you just mentioned, because it's great having well-being classes. It's great talking about it. There are some really supportive things out there for children now. But if children weren't in school for the amount of hours they are, if they weren't expected to then come home and do a lot of homework, if they weren't expected to do X, Y, and Z, which I think is detrimental in so many ways, then you wouldn't need these kind of sort of well-being sticky plasters that are kind of helping, because you're actually creating a lifestyle and a way of learning and their environment, which is supportive to them to grow as human beings in a way that you're going to do that. So, it seems like a massive idea, but like say, and it is a little bit chalk and cheese. You're sort of saying one thing, but almost causing the problem in the other way. And I think that kind of sort of just struck me from what you said there.
Right. I think what happens a lot of times in any phase or institution, or any phase of life or institution, is if a change is really hard, you're going to find a million ways to talk yourself out of it until you're forced to. And that's what we were talking about in terms of AI. Right now, I don't think educators really perceive AI as fundamentally changing what and how they teach. But I think it's only a matter of time because it's moving so quickly. And then I'm confident that there's a lot of intelligent, creative people who will make that adjustment very, very well. The question is, can we get them to make it earlier? Can we make sure the system doesn't get behind the incredible pace that's happening in the rest of life? That's a very difficult challenge, but it starts one teacher at a time. It starts one school at a time.
Exactly. And that's why I love what we're doing here, the ability to be able to share that. And I also hope that the number of people within the school system, especially many of the pupils who are feeling frustrated and disengaged with everything, they're the people that will want it to be different. And so as soon as they see there's an option for that to be different and a positive way of doing that, that they can sort of start that sort of snowball, even if it's just in a, like I say, very small conversational or way they're working now or the way they want it to work, then things will change, like I say, bit by bit, and hopefully enough people will sort of recognize that and say, ah, yes, that's much more me than what I thought I had to be like or how I had to be. And then, we will see. I guess hopefully we're not going to be here in 10 or 15 years' time still having the same conversation, but there seems to me that isn't likely to be possible based on the speed of change.
Well, I mean, I think unfortunately it is possible that school will... you know, like I said, put their fingers in the air and say, la, 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 and keep doing things the same way. But there are, especially public schooling, but there are movements afoot. I don't know if the school choice or vouchers kind of discussion or movements are happening on your side of the water. But, you know, there are a lot of places here, some of it through political motives, but that are basically saying, you know, here, we're going to give parents a certain amount of money and let them pick what schools their kids go to, right? And that will encourage the growth of private schools that have very different models, and then the customers will choose. And so there is this sense that I get that in the public school world, and it's just a vibe, that, you know, we're always going to be here. Or we're always going to be really the dominant player in defining what our kids learn. I'm not sure that's true, and it might take a lot of fleeing students to teach that lesson. We'll see. It, you know, a lot of ways this could go. Everything from there's a major AI bad effect that we see in a year or two, and everybody cuts back and takes stock and reevaluates. Or it could be that, you know, even if it takes a third of the teachers pick it up and start using it for something they do, you know, lesson prep would have been my favorite, right? Because I would always have, you know, creating the individual lesson was fine, but then I needed like five different variants for my special needs kids, or I needed, you know, I can just ask. I mean, I can just ask AI to do that for me now, right? There's AI out there that will take your podcast and have it spoken in umpteen different languages and actually change your, if you wanted to, change the video so that your mouth looks like it's speaking in those other languages. And you could do that in 20 minutes. Yeah. So, you know, if you can do things that are laborious fast, that's where it's going to, that's what I tell teachers, pick something that's a pain in the neck for you and work on, let's work on that.
Yeah. And in terms of where you like your book to sit in terms of people's perceptions, sort of getting this sort of message out there, sort of being able to sort of share this work, are there people thinking, I kind of knew that, but I wasn't able to articulate it in the same way? Is it a kind of a light bulb moment for people? What sort of feedback are you getting?
You know, it's funny because when I bring out the points that I bring, and those points are largely, look, you all think you want to move in the right direction, right? Everybody's talking about the same kind of skills that I'm touting. I think the what I'm delivering is that you're just not going to get there with the kind of model that we have and even the kind of structure that schooling has. So that's been my biggest point, is you're going to have, there's going to have to be a change in some of the fundamentals. And, you know, I happen to socialize, at least online, with a lot of the people who are the most forward thinking about this. But I would say if I went to most schools and gave that message, that you're just not going to teach critical thinking unless you dramatically change the way you're structured and what you teach, most of them will throw up their hands and say, well, what am I supposed to do? You know, I have education standards that I have to meet. They got to be prepared for the SAT. You know, what can I do? Right? So everybody is stymied in some way. And, you know, that's why I often talk about the system having certain properties and the system being wrong, but not the individuals. The individuals really feel like they're part of what's, you know, the river that's the current that's sweeping them along. So, you know, I think a lot of times the message I'm bringing is really hard for folks to take because they don't see something very actionable in it. So that's why I really focused on this game-based learning as a part of that, this, you know, other forms of experiential learning, because I think most classrooms have or are moving toward more project-based learning. And this is a supplement to that. This just says, well, look, if I do project-based learning, maybe I can only teach one or two projects through this time period, right? But I need that variety if they're going to come away with these concepts, right? I need them to see, you know, not just when I mixed this chemical with that chemical, this happened, but I need to see what I mixed that chemical with 10 other ones, right? I don't have time for that. So this is where the sort of game-based learning can really fold in. And I can go to ask ChatGPT to generate me a bunch of games and generate the code to run them and have the students do that at home. You know, a different form of homework that's much more engaging and much more experiential. So I tend to preach, you know, I'll give the big message about they really need these structural changes, but that one's hard for people to take and do with. So you got to break it down into manageable, specific steps forward. And collectively, if there's a lot of those steps forward, the system will change.
Yeah, I love that. And I think that's very much the message that's come out of this show over the last few years, is that you can get very frustrated, like I say, with those structural ideas. But then, you know, I can have this conversation and ask this question with this child in this way. And that's made a difference in the here and now. And like I say, I think what you're talking about enables that to happen from a very purposeful way, from a teacher's point of view. And then you sort of feel like you've got a little bit more control. And like I say, when you combine all the different elements you've spoken about now, I find it an exciting prospect, like I say, rather than just that kind of, we just wish the silver bullet would come along to make a big difference from there. Is there an education experience that you remember? And we sort of spoke about the idea of how a teacher sort of made you feel before, but something that sort of had that kind of impact, and how did that sort of work within your, like say, your career beyond that?
Yeah, I think I'll pick one that I somehow hadn't thought about for a while, but I thought about this morning because I knew you'd ask this question. My senior year of secondary school, there was a computer science course that a teacher started up. Now this is 1981, and there's a teacher who took the energy to start a new course, There were maybe six of us in the course, so a small course. We worked with the teacher. There were no lectures. It was an entirely project-based course where we sat down in computers and tried to figure out how to program. And these were Radio Shack computers with a cassette tape, right? So the storage unit. But that teacher took a gamble in a lot of dimensions, right? There's still over half of the schools in the United States, over half of the high schools in the United States don't teach a single computer science course. This teacher was doing it in 1981, right? 40 plus years ago. And so I can't even remember that teacher's name, but that teacher made an impact because I ended up going into that field and I may never have otherwise done so. I also happened to go to a college that was the first college in the United States to hand out a personal computer to every student. I was lucky. I got that exposure early on, whereas most folks would never have. And it took energy of one person to make that happen.
Yeah, and I love the way that feeds into what we were talking about. You know, what can I do now? And what am I passionate about? That's the thing, isn't it? Because that then comes across in the same way as that comes across from what you've been talking about and how you've been describing your work today as well. What's the best piece of advice you've ever been given? Or indeed, is there a piece of advice you'd give your younger self now looking back?
Well, look, I still think the best piece of advice is follow passion. Passion doesn't always pay and keep you fed, but I think it's where you have to start. And I would say that about classrooms too. Follow your students' passions. They will learn more that way than whatever you try to stuff into them. Obviously that has to be compensated with the realities. But I think most people will find a passion that they can still cling on to. And it may be that 60% of the job stinks, but there's that piece. There's those parts of the day that I look forward to, right? And if you have that and you have good people around you, just people that care about you, you'll have a wonderful life and a career.
Yeah.
It's simple. It's passion and it's surrounding, putting yourself in the right environments. Nothing can beat that.
Yeah, really powerful. I could definitely relate to that as a musician who sort of followed that dream and it sort of fits really nicely with what you said before, because the only reason I became a musician is because we had passionate music teachers who wanted to give everyone the opportunity to learn an instrument when I went to secondary school. Without that, who knows where that would have come, but it was the opportunity, it was that teacher doing something different, and then the ability to follow that through, which sort of led me into experiencing what that passion is. And that's the other thing, isn't it, about, you know, you need to have those experiences to know what it is and that sort of speaks to you and how you take that forward. Is there a resource you'd like to share? And this can be professional or personal, anything from a podcast, a video, song, film, book, but something that's had an impact.
You know, I'll just keep it topical. I think there are a lot of people who have decided they need to form an opinion about AI. And it's a bit like saying, what's your opinion about computers? Well, there's good and bad, and it depends on how they're used and for what reason and what time. But those opinions usually are coming with surveys that also show that most educators actually have never even tried it. So I think people need to do themselves a favor and try it out, and they can let their students guide them, right? Mm-hmm. In a lot of cases, their students will be able to show them how to use it. It should be you don't want to pick the free version of ChatGPT for that tryout, right? You want to pick, you know, the better version, which is either paid and maybe you're just borrowing it from somebody, you know, somewhere else in the school at $20 a month that are using it, or you can get that paid version in the Bing search engine. You can now not just search, but you can ask it, you can chat with the search engine. And so I think it's important that people get a sense for what it can and can't do. You know, tell it what your next lesson is and ask for ideas. And And so only then, I think, can we really start to chip away at what is it, how it's used, when shouldn't it be used, et cetera. But I think if people are giving opinions, and right now I'm just seeing the sense of people feel like they need to say, I hate this, I love this, whatever it is, but half of the community hasn't tried.
Yeah. And I love that. From hopefully this conversation's enabled that to get people thinking in a different way, and like I say, and sort of go and look at it in a different way. And just as we start to round off then, obviously the acronym FIRE is important here at Education on Fire. And by that we mean feedback, inspiration, resilience, and empowerment. What is it that strikes you when you hear that?
Oh, the resilience one is the one I think I most resonate with. You know, life doesn't follow a linear path. And so, you know, teaching our kids that failure is okay. It's not only okay, it's necessary to learn in some cases. And you just want to make the failures not be painful, right? I don't want a kid to get a D because they tried something new. So that resilience relies on failure, and we need to give our kids problems that require try, iterate, fail along the way until you get better.
I love that.
I think that's the one that if kids have resilience, that's a big part of the grit that we talk about, and they'll do just fine through life with that skill.
It's certainly something as a parent we spoke about, was that sense of you need to learn from experience. We want to give you the opportunity to try things. And like I say, with that comes failure and success and all the sort of the areas in between. But having the knowledge and understanding as an adult, as someone who's more experienced, not who's got all the answers, but someone who's got the experience, hopefully what we can do is give you that soft landing or give you that chance to do it, like you say, in that environment, which is a positive one. I can really identify with that. It's a really, really, really important piece there. Thank you so much for sharing all of this. It really is fascinating to me, and it's something that I've spoken a lot about in recent weeks in lots of conversations that I've had, and everything's been sort of a running theme, but there's been so many different grey areas in terms of people's perceptions and how it works, and I think that's what I'm finding really fascinating. So Tim, thanks so much for being here. Do tell people where the best place is for them to obviously get your book, but also in terms of sort of finding out more about you.
Sure. The book is called Wisdom Factories, AI Games and the Education of a Modern Worker. It's Amazon, Barnes & Noble, wherever books are sold. Amazon is the only place they can get the ebook. The print versions are available anywhere. And then my website is timdacey.com. Dacey is Dasey. And that's where I talk about a bunch of professional development and consulting services, as well as, my book. So, and a link to your podcast will show up there soon.
Fantastic, isn't it? And we'll have links to all your website and the books and that kind of thing on the show notes as well, so people can find that really easily. I really appreciate your time, Tim. Thank you so much indeed. And
this has been great, Mark. Thank you.
Keep up the great work. Thank you for listening and being part of this wonderful community. With over 300 episodes, I've collated 20 resources from guests that have been on the show to help you in your educational journey and those of you involved with young people. Just go to educationonfire.com and you can sign up on the homepage. Thanks for listening to the Education on Fire podcast. For more information of each episode and to get in touch, go to educationonfire.com. Education is not the filling of a pail, but the lighting of a fire.